The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
So, good evening, everyone. Welcome if you're new, and welcome if you're not. My name is Mara Young, and Mark is away. Can you hear me okay? Or is this? Mark is out of town this evening, so he asked me to take the talk this evening. So I'm really happy to always support Mark and offer whatever Dharma I can at Common Ground. This evening's talk is entitled Equanimity, Love and the Awakening Mind, The Milk of the Dharma. The milk of the Dharma. I'd like to start with, I guess I'll share a little bit more about who I am, and then I'd like to jump into our exploration of this practice of equanimity. So I'm a longtime member of Common Ground, as some of you may know, and of the Twin City Vipassana community. And I've been practicing in this tradition for about 18 years, and prior to that in the yoga tradition for about 13 years. And I also teach mindfulness-based stress reduction at the U of M. And I also teach a course on happiness and emotional healing there. And I teach some other classes at the School of Social Work at St. Kate St. Thomas. On incorporating mindfulness into psychotherapy. So I'm also a psychotherapist in private practice at Rivers Way Meditation Center. So that's enough about me. So I'd like to dedicate tonight's talk to my mother. My mom passed away a week ago this evening. And equanimity has been my companion throughout this week. And so I'm really happy to be able to share more about this wonderful practice. The Buddha said that better than 1,000 hollow words is one word that brings peace. This is a poem. Part of a poem called Accepting This. Equanimity is about accepting things as they are. This is a portion from his poem. And Mark Nepo is a wonderful poet, and he himself is a cancer survivor. He says, "We cannot eliminate hunger, but we can feed each other. We cannot eliminate loneliness, but we can hold each other. We cannot eliminate pain, but we can live a life of compassion. Ultimately, we are small living things awakened in the stream, not gods who carve out rivers. Like human fish, we are asked to experience meaning in the life that moves through the gills of our heart. We are asked to experience meaning in the life that moves through the gills of our heart. There is nothing to do and nowhere to go. Accepting this, we can do anything, we can do everything, and go everywhere. There is nothing to do and nowhere to go. Accepting this, we can do everything and go anywhere." I'm going to share some definitions of equanimity with you that I've gathered from some different wonderful sources and teachers. It is the unattached awareness of one's experience as a result of perceiving the impermanence of momentary reality. Equanimity, it is the peace of mind of abiding calmness that cannot be shaken by any grade of either fortune or unfortunate circumstance. It is not a thought nor an emotion. It is rather the steady conscious realization of reality's transience. It is the ground for wisdom and freedom and the protector of compassion and love. While some may think that equanimity is as a dry neutrality or cool aloofness, kind of an indifference, mature equanimity produces a radiance and warmth of being. The Buddha described a mind filled with equanimity as abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. The Pali word for equanimity, as some of you may know, is upekkha. I also learned that there's actually two Pali words for equanimity. I'd only been familiar with upekkha. And upekkha is that quality that means that we can look over, we can observe. So we can develop this capacity, this power to observe things without reactivity, which is also, equanimity is cultivated by mindfulness. I mean, mindfulness is kind of the king and equanimity is the queen. So this first meaning, this first word of upekkha is to look over. So we have that power to observe what's going on without being caught in it. And when it's well developed, it gives a great sense of peace. And that we can learn to what's called see with patience. This is that quality upekkha, is to see with patience. We might understand this as seeing with understanding. So like when someone might say something that might offend us or hurt us, we might not take it so personally. We're less likely to react to what's said. I love this next part. It's said that instead, that this form of equanimity, to see with patience, is like a grandmother, a grandmotherly love. That the form of equanimity is compared to a grandmother's love. A grandmother clearly loves her grandchildren, but thanks to her experience with her own children as a mother, she's less likely, perhaps a little less likely, to get caught up in the drama of her grandchildren's life. So it's that maybe grandmotherly or perhaps grandfatherly quality. Now the second word for equanimity in Pali, and I don't know if I'm saying this correctly because I just learned it, is Tatra Majja Hata. Tata. Tatra Majja Hatata. And Majja I'm familiar with because it's middle, like the middle way. Now, this translation, Tatra, means there and is sometimes referred to as all things. And Majja means, or Maha means middle. And Tata means to stand. So when you put this all together, it means to stand in the middle. And equanimity is about balance. So that capacity to stand in the middle, to find our balance, is what this Tata, Tatra, Maha, Hatata means. So just say Tata. Anyway, let it go. So this develops a strong presence, an inner calm, confidence, vitality, or integrity that can keep us upright, like a ballast in a ship, upright against the strong winds. And some of you are familiar with, or perhaps not, the eight worldly winds. So life is filled with these winds, right? You know, praise and blame, success and failure, pain and pleasure, fame and disrepute. These are the classic eight worldly winds that sweep through our lives. You know, one moment, I was on a retreat with Nyingma Rinpoche for about a month, and every day he'd come in, we'd have just about every day in the evening, he'd check in with us, and we'd have like a Dharma teaching. But first thing he'd say in his lovely accent, which I'll try to imitate but do poorly, is, so, how is stock market today? You know? And then he'd listen, he'd say, and he'd ask, and people would say, how, good meditation, bad meditation? How was the meditation? How was the stock market? And inevitably, and he'd say, okay, raise hand. How many people, good meditation? No, a few hands would go up. How many people, bad meditation? More hands would go up. How many people, come see, come sigh? And then the rest would raise their hand. And every day he'd ask us, and again throughout, you know, 20-some days of practice, and so that we could see just how things are so changeable, up and down. One day my hand was up, one day my hand was down, when it, you know, and then after a while it didn't matter anymore, right? Good, bad, high, low, pain, pleasure, just to observe it, just to find the balance. So actually, Gil Fronsdale describes 7 mental qualities of equanimity. So I'll just kind of touch those briefly, and don't try to necessarily remember them all, but we can listen with an open heart. The first is virtue or integrity. And why would we think that virtue and integrity would be one of the mental qualities for equanimity? You know, and I think it doesn't take, you know, we can reflect on that, and that if we're living with integrity, I was talking with one of my clients today about, you know, being committed, living from your own truth, from your values, you know, versus so much externally on what you think, you know, someone else needs or wants you to be, or how you think you should be in order to be loved or accepted. You know, to live with that integrity, follow a virtue, you know, to not harm, to be in alignment with truth, that and that brings a kind of a peace of mind, a blamelessness. And the second support for equanimity to develop is faith, a kind of faith that can provide a grounded wisdom, a confidence. You know, how many of us, and I won't ask you to raise hand, but how many of us don't have much faith in our capacity to practice or to awaken? I know I haven't. You know, we doubt ourselves, and sometimes we doubt the Dharma, and we don't think, well, it can work for everyone else, but not for me. But this cultivation, when a faith begins to develop in us, and there's different types of faith in that development process, we can begin to feel a confidence. Like, I'm really grateful that at this point in my practice, I have no doubt. I really trust the Dharma. I have no doubt about the Dharma. I may still have doubts about my own capacity, but I really, you know, have that faith that these are practices that can support life and bring freedom. And then the third support for equanimity is a well-developed mind. And these are also go along with some of the 7 factors of awakening, which are mindfulness, development of mindfulness, and concentration, and calm or tranquility, that we can develop these qualities of the mind. You know, how many of us often dwell in a lot of negativity, and we're caught up? You know, we lose that sense of balance, and we go off the cliff into the trough of self-hatred and despair and self-judgment and poor me, and that we can actually develop, and Mark told me that he's been teaching on the paramis, these wholesome qualities of mind, and equanimity is one of these paramis, and calm, mindfulness, concentration, really developing this in the mind, just like we might go to the gym and develop a muscle and a capacity to run. Some of my clients are running triathlons, and another member here is running one for raising some money for cancer research, and more power to them. You know, but, you know, one of them I know said, you know, she didn't even have a bicycle. You know, so, you know, you begin to cultivate those muscles and that capacity to do a triathlon. You can also cultivate the capacity to develop concentration and mindfulness and calm. So the fourth support for equanimity is well-being. We don't have to leave well-being to chance. In Buddhism, it's considered appropriate to cultivate, enhance our well-being. It's not selfish to feel well. You know, a lot of us struggle, well, if I put my well-being, that means that I'm better than others or that I'm not serving. But actually, cultivating that well-being is something that we can do that brings joy to the mind. Take time to enjoy a cup of tea or the sunset. This afternoon, I was looking out the window while I was preparing the talk, and I noticed that in between the rain, that suddenly there was steam. I thought I was seeing things. There was steam rising from the roof from the hot day of the garage next door. And then the sparkle of the drops of rain on the green leaves. And there was just that moment of well-being and a kind of quiet joy, just watching that steam rise. You know? So that supports equanimity. We can learn to develop a fifth support is wisdom. So we can start to separate other people's actions from who they are. So we become less judgmental. We become more accepting of ourselves and others. Wisdom supports equanimity and understanding that people are responsible for their own decisions, which helps us find equanimity in the face of other people's suffering. We can wish the best for them, but we can avoid by being buffeted by a false sense of responsibility for their well-being. I don't know about you, but, you know, I'm a professional caretaker, and I came by it well as a young child, and years of this sort of caretakey stuff. And finding the difference between true caring and being able to hold the space for people to have their process and their struggle without getting in there and trying to fix it or think that I have any answers, you know? And also not take it on. Well, I'm a bad therapist because I can't make it for them, or I'm a bad mom, or it's my responsibility taking it on. And all that does is create a burden in your own heart. But it doesn't mean that we don't care and we don't do our best and we don't offer support. So wisdom. And the sixth support is insight. That's deep seeing into the nature of things. And one of that primary insight, like I read in the first definition about equanimity, is impermanence. That everything arises and passes away. You know, seeing how quickly my mother lived to be have a full life, and she had many illnesses and suffering, but the last year of her life, while she was declining, was relatively free of hospitalizations for almost a year, and. You know, she was very happy and joyful, and before her body started to fail, that same evening, she was looking at pictures of her new great-grandchild. She was, you know, feeling happy and well and expecting to be discharged to home in a couple of days. In fact, that's what I heard. Oh, she's there, and we expect her to be home in a couple days in the hospital. And then things changed. And, you know, she was gone within less than 24 hours. You know, so we don't know, you know. So the real teaching of impermanence. And hopefully we don't have to wait till we're on our deathbed or watch someone we love to recognize that. We can recognize how everything is so fleeting and changing. And that deep insight helps us, the mind, to let go of clinging. We might cling less. In fact, my car of the last decade or so decided to quit, like just break down, like stop running. And the repairs are more than the worth of the car. And I realized that today, as I was noticing cars of that particular type, and I was starting to feel this, that was my car, and that was my Dharma mobile, and I drove to this retreat in that car, and that brand of car, you know, and then I saw that, and I started to laugh at myself, and I thought, you know, it's not bad or good. I mean, it's like, it's okay, you know, I'm going to miss my car, but because it suddenly quit running, and it needed all this repair work. But, you know, it's so easy to see how attached we get and how quickly things can change. And then the final support for equanimity is freedom. And that comes when we let go of our reactive tendencies. And we get a taste of this when we're reactive, but we aren't any longer. And actually, what do you think is one of the best ways to develop equanimity? Is when you are reactive. You see where your reactivity is, and that actually strengthens the power of equanimity, because you see the places where you get caught, you get reactive. So rather than feel bad about it and beat yourself up, you can be thrilled, even, like grateful, like, wow, okay, here's an area that I can work with. And we can also see that perhaps there's some issues that used to upset us, like when we were teenagers or younger, that no longer bother us anymore or have a meaning. Like, I mean, you know, maybe if it was my first car and I was 18 years old or something, and I might be a lot more upset about it. But now, so different cars and repairs later, it's like, oh well, it's just a car. No, oh well. So we're car sharing. So, okay. So these two forms of equanimity that come from the power of observation and the one from inner balance come together in mindfulness practice. And as mindfulness becomes stronger, so does our equanimity. We see with greater independence and freedom. And at the same time, equanimity becomes an inner strength that keeps us balanced in the middle of all that is. Okay. Actually, in talking about strengthening equanimity, I have a difficult family member I've often mentioned in here. And some of you may have, probably don't have any difficult people, family members. I'm probably the only one. But this difficult family member was kind of, I was noticing while I was this past weekend around them that I was pretty equanimous. Equanimity was really pretty strong. But then at one point, I felt like, ooh, like they said something, and they basically told me in not these words to basically shut up and don't say anything. So I didn't like that, and I came back to where I was after this interaction. And I just acknowledged it, that there was this anger, that I felt this anger when this person made a comment to silence me or to tell me basically not to say anything in this situation this past weekend. And I saw the anger come up, and I had a couple people I could trust. And for a few moments I said, I'm not going to do anything about this, but I just need to acknowledge that I'm really pissed off. This anger has arisen, and I made some comment. And then the person that I was angry with came out to the deck we were sitting on. And I took a breath, and I turned to them, and I thanked them for whatever, something else that they did that was really, that went really well in the next moment. And I thought to myself, wow, this equanimity practice is really working. You know, I literally was like, ah. And there wasn't any, like, it wasn't fake. I mean, in the next moment, it was like, you know, you really handled that well. Thank you. And then actually later, the person apologized to me. Said, well, you know, I didn't mean whatever, but blah, 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 which was rare. You can see I have more work to do. So, Ajahn Chah, who is a wonderful forest master, he talks about that unwholesome states of mind are like a cobra. Okay? So, and I'm going to ask, I found some really rich stuff I want to share, but I want also to give you a chance to reflect, and I have some inquiry for you about these areas, like where you want to bring more equanimity to and where it's difficult and where, you know, it's easier, and just what about that for yourself tonight. But I do want to share a little more in a couple of really wonderful poems. But he talks about living with the cobra. And that that it's necessary to really cultivate and maintain our mindfulness. And let's see, how does he say it here? We say that mental activity is like a deadly poisonous cobra. If we don't interfere with the cobra, it simply goes on its way. You can raise hands. Has anyone had encounter with cobra? Oh, okay. So you don't want to interfere with it, right? I recently read a story where somebody actually, fortunately the cobra had another animal in its mouth because the guy didn't see it and leaned on it. But, no problem. But you don't want to mess with the cobra. But we'll get completely messed up into our own machinations, our own mind, our mental activity, particularly the negative stuff. So that even though it's extremely poisonous, we're not affected by it. We don't go near it. We don't take a hold of it. It doesn't bite us. The cobra does what is natural for a cobra to do. That's the way it is, Ajahn Chah says. If you are clever, you'll leave it alone. And so you let that be that which is good. You also let be that which is not good. Let it be according to its own nature. Let it be like, let it be your liking and your disliking, the same way you don't interfere with the cobra. So this possibility of not, this non-clinging, this not getting caught up in that liking or disliking, because we always want the things we like, and that causes us as much suffering and imbalance than when we're with the disliking. So that non-reactivity, that letting go, brings that equanimity, and we don't get bit. You know, it doesn't mean that you don't enjoy a good ice cream cone on a hot day. It's just you let go of that attachment around it. You let go of that suffering when you don't get it. At this retreat that I was at with Mingyur Rinpoche, it was on a college campus, and we had dorm food, you know. And fortunately, dorm food has become somewhat more enlightened, although I talked with a friend of mine today who took her son to his college for orientation this last week in another part of the country, and she said that in by the guy's dorm, all they had was foot-long fried whatever, and the way in the back was a tiny salad bar. But where I was, we had a huge salad bar and all. But after a few weeks of dorm food, you know. But it was like it was just for a few weeks, and that's the equanimity. Okay, so what? You know, so I live on salad for a few days and ice cream. It's okay. They had soft serve ice cream anytime you wanted. So we don't usually have on retreats, so the yogis went a little nuts. You should have seen what we would make ourselves. One teacher made root beer floats. So this is a little wisdom from Ken McLeod on equanimity. He says, pay attention to the experience of equanimity. What is it? Where is it? Where does it come from? Don't try to analyze it. Just rest looking at the experience of equanimity. Maybe you felt that during the guided meditation. You know, where is it? What is it? How do I experience that? At every stage of practice, the price has to be paid for clarity. The price is the loss of an illusion. In equanimity, you lose the illusion that your preferences and prejudices accurately reflect what is real. I read that one again. In equanimity, you lose the illusion that your preferences and prejudices accurately reflect what is real. Equanimity practice is tough. It at first exposes prejudices and then works to pry you loose from them. Not everyone lets go easily. So it's tough. You know, and you cannot practice equanimity or any of the four immeasurables with the intellect, like loving kindness, compassion, and joy. More often than not, the intellect's in service of habituated patterns. And even when it isn't, we don't have enough energy to penetrate the reactive emotions, let alone dismantle them. You can't necessarily think your way through these practices. But if you do, you'll only develop a veneer of equanimity, or one of the other immeasurables, a veneer that will shatter as soon as you encounter a real difficult situation. As the Dalai Lama once said, patience with friends is easy. Patience with those you dislike is what counts. So this is how we learn to develop ourselves in these ways, with equanimity. It's really tempting because just a couple more things about equanimity. So noticing, how many of you ever notice when you might drop spontaneously into times of equanimity, times of peace, times of balance? I mean, all of us, no matter how much we struggle or suffer, probably have moments, maybe we haven't even noticed them yet, where we feel some balance or some ease that's not so dependent on external conditions. You know, it might be that moment of just listening to the rain. It can be very simple. In fact, with Mingyur Rinpoche, the less special your meditation was, the more you were really actually meditating. One nun who had practiced with him for some years, you know, shared that, you know, he asked her, how's your meditation? She said, nothing special. He said, great, you know, good meditation. You know, because we're looking for some extraordinary experience. But equanimity may have a more subtle flavor. You know, it's not like fire engine red. You know, it's not bright electric green like a friend of mine wore his bike shirt today to Qigong. It was like electric green. Somebody said, well, they won't hit you, but they might because of the shirt. Anyway, it's really green. You know, but equanimity is more soft, you know, mossy. And sometimes it's so subtle we don't even see it, but we can feel it. We can sense it. Equanimity is actually a practice where you can have your cake and eat it too, which I love hearing because I like sweets. And when you apply equanimity to unpleasant sensations, they flow more readily. and as a result cause less suffering. And when you apply equanimity to pleasant sensations, they also flow more readily and give you a deeper fulfillment. So equanimity is not, again, this cold, detached, indifferent quality. It's actually a warmth. And I want to share that actually another synonym for equanimity is love. Equanimity is love. And I'd like to share some poems that and something from Shantideva about how equanimity is love. This is by Mark Nepo. Utterance that rises briefly from the source. So equanimity is also known as unshakable peace. Peace. Peace is an odd word for the bubble of all there is, breaking repeatedly on the surface of the heart. But I know of no other. The Native Americans come closest, nothing between inner events and what to call them. I see you and you always glow. Why not call you one who shines like a sun upon first meeting? Why not call the moment of fear and doubt? Dark, pointing, spinning loose that presses on the throat. Why not call the moment of certainty the fleeting moment when everything that ever lived is right behind my pounding heart? Why not call that moment beat of the thousand wings of God inside my chest? When I feel love so deeply that I can't bear it, when I feel it so much that it cannot be contained or directed at any one thing or person, why not call it the stone at the bottom of the river that sings? Why not call it the stone at the bottom of the river that sings? Why not call you the hand that plucks me from the bottom of the river? Why not call this miracle of life the sound that never stops stirring, the lost within the sound that never stops soothing, the living within the sound that never stops sounding, in the eyes of the dead, things coming alive again and again. Shantideva says in his guide of the Bodhisattva's way of life, like a blind man discovering a jewel in a heap of rubbish, likewise, by some coincidence, an awakening mind has been born in me. And equanimity is that unshakable peace of an awakened mind. It is the supreme medicine that quells the world's disease. It is the tree that shelters all beings, wandering and tired on the path of conditioned existence. It is the universal bride that leads to freedom from unhappy states of birth. It is the dawning moon of the mind that dispels the torment of disturbing conceptions. It is the great sun that finally removes the misty ignorance of the world. It is the quintessential butter from churning the milk of the Dharma. It is the quintessential butter from churning the milk of the Dharma for all those guests traveling on the path of conditioned existence who experience the boundaries of happiness. They will satisfy them with joy and actually place them in supreme bliss. The quintessential butter from the churning of Dharma into milk, equanimity. So let's just sit for a few moments. And I'd like to guide you a little further in that reflection for our discussion. Take a moment and be open to whatever arises without judgment. Invite memory, invite whatever wants to come up of times of peace. Equanimity, moments where you have experienced or tasted peace. Equanimity, balance, ease. And feel how that feels in your body, mind. The flavor of equanimity. The felt sense and the sensations of it. When have I felt balanced and equanimous? What brings equanimity into my heart, into my life? Where and with whom and what situations, issues, emotions, areas of my life are asking for more equanimity? Where is it challenging? That's where the muscle grows. That's the sand in the oyster. And where are those places where there's some access or ease, where I find balance? It may be a simple walking the dog in the dog park, or a cup of coffee with awareness. So take a few more moments to reflect, and then we can drop into stillness. And then when you hear the bell next, we'll open up for some sharing or discussion. Your turn. What's bubbling up here?
Yes.
Yeah. No one said no.
I'm Stacy, by the way. So I had a lot of big, strong emotions, like riding a fucking Bronco today. And I've been practicing for a while, but when you're caught, tell me again the thousandth time, what do you do?
You know, that's what Sangha is. That's what our community of fellow practitioners are. They help us remember. They're like tying the string around the finger. Because when we're caught and we're in it, that's often what we need to do, is we help. Exactly what you're doing. So number one is what you just did. Help. I'm caught. Remind me. Okay. And that means, one is there's already awareness that you're caught. And then there's the activity of reaching out for support from other Dharma supporters. So that's wonderful. So already that's starting to bring the possibility of the letting go, or you know, some hopefully connection, you know. And there's many, many skillful ways. But one is to remember. You can use equanimity practice. And actually, there was a time in my practice where it was a really rough time of transition some years ago, and my primary teacher suggested that I do equanimity practice because there was so much imbalance and so much intense emotions and things and changes going on that were very difficult. So all conditioned things arise and pass away. You know, this too shall pass. You know, these emotions, like even the ones, it's a coaster, right? and it's up and it's down, and it's all around. And when we think we need to stop a roller coaster, what will happen? I mean, what would happen if we threw ourselves in front of a roller coaster? But what if we just said, okay, we observed the equanimity, we watch it. We feel, we see the sensations. We note it to our capacity. We get support. You know, we begin to cultivate, you know, that what's going to bring balance in my heart and mind given that there's so much intensity right now. I actually sat down with a client today and together we crafted a list of about half a dozen possibilities. You know, things, everything from what to do with your mind when it's, you know, the vulture is attacking you, and what to do, you know, is an activities, including everything from calling people to making lists to, you know, doing something really mundane. So I think it's a lot of compassion. And if other people want to share what helps them, I don't want to dominate the conversation. But I trust that this too shall pass. And whatever works to support you, to be able to be less identified with the emotion, but to let it move through you, feeling it. The equanimity actually helps us feel it. When we get overwhelmed with emotion and lost in it, it's helpful to sometimes find some skillful means that help us find a little more balance, because it's harder to ride the coaster without equanimity, without that capacity or mindfulness to be present with it. We get overwhelmed. So, I mean, we could have a whole conversation, but how about other people? Do you want to share what's helpful to you? Not to, you know, try to fix it, but just what your experience is from your own. Yes, please.
What I've noticed in my body is, and obviously you're dealing with a lot of strong emotion at that time. You're dealing with a lot of strong emotions when you're stuck, and it is easy, you know, proliferation.
You bet.
But allowing yourself to feel, you said that a moment ago, but allowing yourself to feel it is pretty critical, I think, to get through it. It can't be impartiality. For me, anyway, it has to be crying, or whatever, but not necessarily getting caught up with all the revenge tendencies or any of that stuff, but I mean, just observing that you feel that way.
Kind of letting it wash
really
through.
That's how you feel. That's how you feel. And that's okay. Just how you feel.
Thank you. Yes?
Finding a way to relax the mind, I find the light take like 10 minutes and you just come through on the breath. Then the emotions aren't quite as overwhelming. The feelings aren't quite as overwhelming. You have a little more space. They're still there, but there's a little more space. A little more peace.
Yeah, absolutely. Going to something more neutral. Because, you know, often where it's painful, the emotions, we like put our full concentration, and we sometimes we need to either kind of make a bigger space for it, or, you know, what you're saying is exactly, you know, going to something more neutral, like a breath, or sometimes we need to go outside and look at the sky, kind of give it more room, you know, kind of holding it in that. Or we might shift to loving kindness practice. You know, compassion for ourselves, for the suffering, you know. So it takes, you know, and we might only be able to touch in and be with that felt sense for short periods, you know, to ride it out. So you find each heart and mind is different, but these are wonderful suggestions. Yeah, one more? Yeah.
Also, what I try to do is I sit with that upsetting thoughts. And what I found, I sit with it, you know, having a thought, he did this to me, having the feeling of anger in my body that I, you know. But what I find is that all of a sudden I get this nothing happen for a second or two, and I go, oh my God, is that all about this upset? There's nothing here, too. And that kind of breaks
probably, actually, there's this great little quote I didn't read about the Buddha said, if you could know kind of how perfect or just how things really are, you just throw back your head and start laughing, you know, at the sky. I mean, we get so consumed, and yet at the same time, you live in a relative reality, and there are things that are very painful, and it's part of a process of awakening. We can't just spiritually bypass it. But what you're saying is, you know, very helpful, very, very skillful means. Yes?
It was the ocean Kelly who said this, that sometimes when we're caught, having this space to be aware that we're caught, it just seems inaccessible.
Mm-hmm.
But just being aware, this is suffering. Mm-hmm. This is suffering. I think sometimes even compassion practice can be hard, but acknowledging this is suffering,
that awareness of the dukkha, the suffering, in and of itself. And often we think we need to do something to get rid of it, but sometimes it's just that little wedge of a moment of awareness, like acknowledging, okay, this is painful, this is dukkha, this is a hell realm.
Yeah.
And what to do, because inherently it will eventually change. That's that faith in impermanence, that trust in that insight, that wisdom. You know, even if we're in the midst of it. And there are very difficult, painful things. We don't want to discount that. And that's where the human heart can respond. But absolutely, sometimes there's nothing that we can do, but we can just be. Yes. We might have time for one or two more comments before our closing loving kindness tonight. Anyone else have some? Yes, please. Hi. Yeah.
I had this moment lately with my husband where I had like this prime opportunity to throw a big "I told you so." You know, it was so right. But to not do it, you know, and I could have like really got into it also. Why, you know, you did, I told you, you know. And, you know, to feel that urge come up so strong and then like to not do it, to not act on it then. It, you know, I think like that question, like what happens when this comes up is, because if we don't get into it, you know, the alternative is peace. And it's like,
yes.
It almost seems boring. Or, you know, and yet that peace was such a, like that wise choice. I could also feel just, so hard to describe, but the peacefulness, you know, how to say, like, there was this huge step forward for me, and so that letting go of it, you know.
I want you to have some high fives here. And how wonderful then you notice the peace, you know, from, you know, that was the pattern, and then the wisdom, the mindfulness came in. Of your practice, you know, those are those times where wow, the practice is working. You know, it's doing me. We're waking up in the middle of the about to moment. And how beautiful, and what a beautiful description of that peace. And you're right. You know, we start to lose that taste for that flaming hot drama, you know, that, you know, it's like you're eating everything filled with sugar and over-salted, and then you start tasting more the subtle flavor, you know, so even to wreck, there's a lot of wisdom and insight in that, you know, because people think, oh, you know, I'll become a meditator, I'll become kind of this zombie, you know. But actually, you know, the taste of freedom, the taste of peace is so delicious and gorgeous. And then how you experience that, I mean, you know, it beats any of those other delights. I mean, you know. So it's an acquired taste. What would you say, Nancy? Would you recommend it? That flavor?
Well, it kind of goes, you know, to show just how we can also, like, be fooled into thinking, like, sweets are just the ultimate, you know. And then just, you know, reflecting on, like, that impermanence of it and what is real sweetness.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Well, we need to finish up. I feel like we could just, but it feels like, wow, I wish I'd want to hear more from you guys, so I'm sorry I talked too much. But I hope you'll take this time to reflect and maybe share with each other or just think about more that, in, you know, what brings equanimity and what are those areas you want to develop more in yourself. And equanimity practice, you can take it on. So let's close with a blend of loving kindness and equanimity and send it out into the world. So we'll finish with that, and then there's a couple announcements here. Okay? So let's settle ourselves down. So we can offer and share the merit of our practice this evening for the awakening and development of equanimity in our own hearts and minds, and out to one another, just as I wish for myself to be well and at peace, equanimous and balanced, with a heart filled with loving kindness and compassion. I wish this for everyone here, peace and happiness and freedom, and then letting it flow out to those near and far, those dear to us, that are known to us, that we share our lives with, and those unknown to us that support our life in this country, in all the countries in the world, in all the sentient beings, you know, from the gulls and the birds and the people at the Gulf with the oil, to Afghanistan and to the Middle East, Darfur, and all over this world, peace, equanimity, freedom, and all sentient beings everywhere in all directions, may we all know true peace, happiness, and freedom, unshakable peace. And we can radiate that out, abundant and exalted, in all directions. Love. Unconditional love.